Welcome to another episode of Movie Raw Minute. This is episode 37. Right now in the middle of season 11, where we're currying our way through the 2001 HBO award-winning miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Christian Taylor Johnson.
Christian Taylor, that will be fine.
Or Christian Taylor, okay.
Hi, everybody.
A documentarian who is an expert on keratin.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
I'm working on a movie about keratin right now.
I am. It's called Heroes of Keratin. You can go to heroesofkeratin.com and see the trailer.
Ooh, very cool. Very cool. Go check it out after you listen to this episode.
Yes.
Exactly. So episode 37 begins with Welsh and McGrath getting ready to take on the tank. And ends with Blythe not really knowing how to respond. So we ended things yesterday right in the middle of this battle. And, I did give a little spoilers by continuing to read from the book to try and prove that this really did happen. But Welsh and McGrath are right there getting ready to take on this tank with a bazooka. And Welsh is basically forcing McGrath to join in with him. And he goes, come on. And McGrath goes, you're going to get me killed, Lieutenant. And he shoots one of the rockets from his bazooka, but it basically just bounces off the tank. And he says, again, I knew you'd get me killed. And at this point, Welsh says to him, don't fire until I tell you, McGrath. And he goes, I knew you were going to get me killed. Like, how many times do you have to say that? And we're watching this battle continue all around them as they're getting ready to try to as they're waiting for Welsh to find the opportune time to finally shoot out at the tank, you know. And they're just I'm assuming it's done here more for the Hollywood effect, you know. I'm assuming it went a lot quicker than what we get to see here, but still there's. You still have a whole bunch of men still shooting at the tank as it's coming by, and McGrath we can see is completely doesn't really know why he's there, but he's just following orders. And Welsh knows what he's doing, and he keeps telling him, it says just wait, hold your fire, and the tank starts getting closer and closer and starts going up on a little bit of a ridge. I think it's called the hedgerow when he goes on, and Welsh tells him, hold your fire. And McGrath goes, no, that's too close. And he goes, son of a bitch. And then the tank shoots. And it just completely takes out a big part of this forest area. And someone screams, medic! And at this point, Welsh says to him, and says, go now. Now, fire McGrath. Because we see that the tank is working its way up, and we can actually see right into the underbelly of it. And that's when he fires, and you see that he gets a direct hit right in the underbelly of the tank, which it has less armor for obvious reasons, because in general you don't need the armor underneath. And we see that the hit really did the damage that they wanted it to do. But we also see the way that the men of Easy have been affected by the way that the tank shell that just came in and shot at them, because we see a few guys that are lying on the ground. They look like they're dead. We see other guys that are injured, but then we see Winters, just showing up once again and showing everyone, including us, why Dick Winters was such a great leader. And he just screams, covering fire! And everyone just starts shooting at the tank that is already damaged. And he screams again, covering fire! And then we see Liebgott, and he goes, keep firing south! And then Welsh takes his position next to Liebgott, and Liebgott turns to him and goes, you had a home run, huh? Which is a great line.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like such a, I don't know, such a calm, like just a hey, that was cool kind of line in the middle of like
Yes.
utter chaos and destruction.
Correct. But again, they're just continuing with the cover fire of these tanks, and then we see one of the guys run, and he gets shot. And he gets shot in the leg. You know, he screams out. They pick up the guy who gets shot in his knee. He's limping over, and the Germans start getting closer. We see other guys get another guy gets shot in the arm,
Starting to
and
look really
Compton.
bad.
That's right, and Compton's taking care of him. And then Bull is running, and Bull gets hit and falls on his back. Again, the first of all, the production that they did on this is just great. I mean, we know all about the training these guys did, but here they must have been using stuntmen also and stuff like that, getting this as proper as possible because of
I mean, for
the technology.
25 years ago, it is pretty amazing. I mean, it's still held holding up.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it looks like Bull, that or at least the guy who's playing Bull, because I don't really think it's Michael Kudlitz here. You know, is it looks like he's might have been in a harness that pulled him down to the ground like really hard, you know, when he gets hit there. But he gets right back up. You know,
Yeah.
and he's not concerned about the fact that he was hit. You know, maybe just skimmed him or whatever. And again, the battle just gets bloodier and bloodier. And we won't go into details, but we do see a whole bunch of guys that get hit. And then we're back with the guys in the mortars, and one of them screams, "Rounds complete! Rounds complete!" Meaning they don't have any more mortar shells to shoot. And he screams to Muck, and he goes, "Skip, more ammo! Go, go!" And he goes, "On my way!" And he starts running off to in the direction. And we see someone taking care of one of the guys that's been injured, and keeps screaming, "Medic, medic!" And another guy just gets shot in the chest as he's taking care of it. And you know, we see guys that are bleeding that are still you know, acting very heroic with what they're doing by still continuing to fire. And you know, these, as you said, these guys feel that they've lost all hope with what's
Yeah.
going on.
Well, and you, what I think the directors did a great job doing in this short scene is, you see this contrast, of, it kind of starts slowly and you see this internal, just tension of what Blythe is going through. And you as the audience are automatically put yourself in Blythe's position and you're feeling what he's feeling. And all the directors are doing is intensifying that feeling.
That's right.
And then Blythe does overcome that and gets into the fight and the fray. But then what happens? His worst fears are being realized in front of him, right?
Yes.
Everything that he possibly could fear is happening to everyone around him. Like no one is safe, clearly, not even Bull.
Correct.
Right? I mean, everyone is getting hit and there's no way you can avoid it. And it's just getting worse and worse. And so you feel this tension building, like all is lost, or this is it.
And then you know, as we get this feeling that everything is lost, that we see a huge explosion, and one of the guys goes, "Jesus, what was that?" And another guy turns around and goes, "Sherman's," and they basically start laughing. And then
Yeah.
we're back on the ridge that we were on yesterday with Nixon and Strayer, and you know, we see the tanks, the Sherman tanks, just getting closer and taking these guys out, taking out the Germans,
Cavalry has arrived.
100%. And I love the nonchalant way that these guys are just standing on their Shermans, just shooting.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
I mean, the first of all, tanks cannot be, appreciated enough in this battle and in Normandy. And people have to understand the Germans had a long time to get their tanks there, right? And they were hidden and they were, they were easily accessible. We had a very difficult time getting our tanks in position and usable. A lot of them sank. They couldn't get off the boats.
We talked about that in part, Ryan. How many of them sunk off the...
Yeah.
But again, this is a week later. It's,
and then once they got... Once the ones did get off the boats, they couldn't get through the hedgerows.
Right.
You know, the hedgerows then became a problem. So it was very, very difficult for our tanks to mobilize. And so, you know, now here they come, finally, they're engaging in the battle and they show up at just the right time.
Exactly. And they just start blasting away at the Germans. And the men of EZ are really, really excited and very happy about this whole thing. For obvious reasons. and as I said, so Nixon sees them and goes, "Well, hello, Second Armored." And then we get a shot of Picante, who goes, "That's right, you sorry asses, run!" And then Welsh says, "Oh, you beautiful babies, you." He goes, "Let's go, pour it on them. Let them have it. Come on, check it out. Sherman's about damn time."
Yeah.
We start seeing the Germans are retreating, you know, and then come on, they start, you know, screaming to try to get things moving a little bit. We still see that both sides are losing men even at this part of the battle. Some of them in pretty descriptive ways,
yeah.
Others not. But Winters is still encouraging the men and has them move forward in order to go help. You know, to continue their part of the battle together with these Shermans,
mm-hmm.
And it's shown really, really well the way that they fight together. You know, both the Shermans and the men of EZ. Then we see one of the guys who's following behind the Sherman. He gets hit in the back and falls down.
Yeah,
but you know they keep going.
I mean, they don't really have any choice. And that's, you know, that's kind of what you see from the very beginning of, you know, like in Saving Private Ryan, if you think about that, you know, you sit on the beach, you're dead. You've got to keep moving. I mean, you see that in the beginning of, I think, the Battle of Carentan, right?
Yeah.
You cannot just stay there.
Right.
Yeah. You have to keep moving.
That's right. And we see also the Germans are panicking and retreating and trying to get out of there. And you know, even the German tanks are you know, going backwards to try and get out of there. And then we see one of the Germans get shot and he falls down. And then he gets run over by the tank because the tank is just trying to get out of there. He doesn't matter to him what's going on. You know, it doesn't matter what's underneath there. And we see that it's almost a full retreat. And then... We're back to Blythe, and Blythe picks up his gun and just aims. You know, not really sure what he's going to do. And one of the guys that's retreating stands behind one of the trees and is getting ready to shoot. And then Blythe shoots at him and somehow hits him like a perfect shot. And a tank goes by, and then the guy is gone. He's not there anymore. And I think part of this is the idea that you know, they want us to believe that Blythe is thinking to himself, you know, did I really just kill someone, or am I just imagining that I'm heroic at this point? You know, yeah. Am I a real hero, or was that just part of the dream of what's going on here? And I like the way they do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it does leave a lot of mystery and question there. For the audience, but again, I think we're in the position of Blythe during these scenes,
mm-hmm.
Because I think he's confused as well.
Yeah. Yeah. He doesn't really know what's going on here either. But again, that's good because the idea is to get us in the head of Blythe.
Right.
And they do a great job of doing that.
Yep.
You know, they even let us see a German helmet start rolling by, and again, mm-hmm. Is he really seeing a German helmet rolling by? Is it the German helmet of this guy that he just saw or not? You know,
yeah.
And then we see a bunch of the guys break out cigarettes. I guess to get the tobacco. I don't know. Just to get
Well,
the
I think it's to
cigarette.
calm them down, you
Right.
know? I mean, like you have
Exactly.
such jittery nerves and there's, you know, you
Correct.
got to figure out some way to.
But I don't think the battle is these guys aren't 100% sure the battle is all completely done. That's the thing.
Yeah.
It's to me it's strange that at this point they would break out the cigarettes. You wait a little bit.
True,
To me
but it
it's
is a
too
movie
quick.
after all.
Well, of course. And then we get a shot of Blythe once again in his foxhole, and he just falls back, tries to take it all in as to what just happened, stuff like that. And then we see a silhouette of a soldier come and stand at the edge of this actually it's a crater. This isn't even the foxhole. It's got to be a crater at this point. And he goes, Hey buddy, you okay? It looked like you fellas had a heck of a fight. A fresh soldier just in that slightly upset that he missed something. That's about it.
Yeah, what a naive perspective.
Yes, of course, but that's the way it's looked upon. And I mean we'll talk about this in a few weeks with the replacements and stuff like that. I mean that's the way that these guys felt,
Yeah.
that
Well,
they want to be, they see these other guys as being heroic and they want to be a part of. They also want people to look at them and think that they're heroic for what they've done.
yeah. Well, I mean, you know, when I first started working on all these World War II stories, it was just shocking to me to have the veterans tell me they knew people who had taken their own lives because they couldn't join the military and fight in the
Yes.
war. You know, and kids that would, you know, do terrible things that, you know, to their parents or like, you know, tell them terrible things to get them to sign off on their paperwork because they weren't 18. And you know, they would basically bribe them or browbeat them into signing their paperwork so that they could join.
Well, because this was the type of war that everyone wanted to be a part of,
Yeah.
for whatever reason,
Yep.
that's the thing. I mean, nowadays, I don't think it would work.
You know, my theory is these guys, this generation, they had grown up hard. C.O. Bauer, I think I've said this before, the veteran in my film, said, "We grew up cold. You know, there's no indoor heating really." They knew they had to just wear coats and blankets, and they grew up, you know, things were hard, and so they were rugged individuals, and they didn't have a lot, and so they just kind of grew up living a hard life. A lot of them grew up during the Depression. They remembered not having a lot, and they had to work hard and work for whatever they had. And I think that's part A. Part B is that our country was attacked, and a lot of them wanted to fight. You know, they're teenage boys. Teenage boys are already full of testosterone and want to fight, you know, and defend. And then C is that all their friends were doing it. All the friends were going, you know. And then you have others who, you know, his parents were like, "You better join so that you don't get assigned, you know, take your pick now," or, you know. So yes, there's multitude of reasons for why people, you know, had that mindset, but those are just some of my theories after talking to so many veterans.
Okay, and it makes a lot of sense. Again, it was a very different time.
Very different time. I talk to my kids in the military now, both of whom oversee younger soldiers. They're apoplectic how they come into the military now. They don't want to work. They are just, you know, having to lower the standards to get them to complete anything. It's just a very, very different culture, and the leaders are very frustrated with the type of kids that are coming into the military now. sad to say.
Again, it's because the way that we look at the youth these days, I guess you can say.
Well, I think, you know, we are a product of our own making. I mean, I hold myself responsible. I do have two kids that are in the military and, you know, of course, and I say that all the time, and, you know, they think that they are, you know, these hard, tough, responsible people. And they are. I mean, they're older now. But I mean, I feel like I was way too permissive with my children and that their life was way too easy. And, you know, we do want them to have the best of everything. I mean, I don't know how many PlayStations and, you know, I don't know, Walkmans back in the 90s or, yes, you know, phones I gave them when I shouldn't have, you know, just too many, they had just had too many things that they didn't need to have. And they were just given them instead of having to earn them. And I just, if I had to do things over again, I think I would have made things a little bit more arduous for my kids. Because I think we just, they've lived too easy and a lot too easy a life.
Oh, there's, you know, you can't change what you did.
As
all parents, you know, have learned over the years.
Yeah.
For better, for worse. You know,
woulda, shoulda, coulda.
That's right. We all look forward to the day when our kids will come to us and say, you know, when you told me that, I didn't understand it back then, but now I understand.
Yeah. Well, I've had my older children tell my younger ones, you know, you really should listen to mom. She's always right.
Okay. Makes a lot of sense. Yeah. So again, this is a 5-minute segment that deals with so much of this part of the Battle of Bloody Gulch, you know.
Battle of Bloody Gulch. And it truly was. It truly was.
It's really interesting to see the way that it's portrayed. And again, for anyone who hasn't read the book, you know, as I pointed out yesterday, when you read the book, you get snippets of the things that are going on, and the artistry of the writers was that they would be able to take, you know, just one paragraph and turn it into something so much more in the script. And
yeah,
they had the basis for something, and then you know, poof, now we have you know, something that's even more profound because we can show you the whole story, not just that one sentence or that one paragraph.
Well, and I want to encourage people, if you're really interested in this kind of history, you can do your own research. The after action reports and are now being readily available through the National Archives. Now, I don't know if these particular ones are, but there are after action reports from World War II that you can find in the National Archives, as well as, you know, images and video clips and, you know, you do have to know your research terms and things like that. And you do have to do a lot of ferreting things out. It is not easy, but it is interesting to read them for yourself. There are also escape and evasion reports I've enjoyed reading because I'm doing another documentary that I'm working on. It's in development called The Brave Dutch. And so it's about the Dutch people that kept alive American airmen. Those are very fascinating to read. So yeah, just if you're interested in this stuff, don't just read the authors. Go back to the original sources.
Yeah, true. But the question is, do you think that the original sources, you know, the after-action reports, do you think that's all 100% accurate also? Or it's just the fact it's more accurate than people's memory?
Yeah, you absolutely have to piece things together. Now, for example, Pat Sealing is a 101st Airborne Division historian. He's now moved on to a unit in Korea, but he was there for quite some time. He and I worked together trying to find all of the soldiers that were in D Company that were at Braycourt Manor prior to Easy Company. So D Company, Charles de Valavier, who's the son of the owner of Braycourt Manor, was sure that there were soldiers that died on his company, on his land before Easy Company. And so we spent a lot of time trying to research that for Charles, because it's been very frustrating for him that everybody's always focused on Easy Company. And we were trying to find all of the names of the people that were on his land and, you know, all the different comings and goings of that day. And there are mistakes in the actor action reports. There are several different mistakes. And so we've had to put several different, you know, pieces of history together in order, including, you know, people's memoirs, morning reports, after action reports, just all sorts of stuff to try to find out who was actually where and when. So yes, it's not just one thing, but usually after action reports, you start there.
Oh, wow. That's really cool. All right. So is there anything else you wanted to discuss about this particular 5-minute segment?
Nope. I am so glad the cavalry has arrived. That's all I have to say.
Exactly. All right, so we are now going to be playing the game today. The segment today is a game where we're going to do World War II movie trivia.
Okay.
We're once again going to test Christian's knowledge of World War II movies.
Good luck with this.
Yeah. Well, again, I have
Christian's knowledge or lack thereof.
I have a lot more faith in you than you do. So let's spin the wheel and see what we get. That. Oh wow, this is a good one for you. All right.
Okay.
I think you might have a chance of getting this one. Okay, in the 1963 film The Great Escape,
okay.
Steve McQueen's character, Captain Virgil the Cooler King Hiltz, attempts to jump over the barbed wire fence with what vehicle?
I have seen this movie, but it was a long time ago.
Well, just think about the
So poster. I'm just going to have to guess. I'm going to say a motorcycle.
Of course. There's no question about it. It is a motorcycle. Very good.
Okay. Yay!
Even though the no one really did that. And when they were escaping from Stalag Luft 3, that didn't happen.
No.
All right. Excellent. Okay, let's spin the wheel again for your next question. And around and around and around the wheel goes. Let's see where it's going to end. Okay. Who starred in the film White Christmas?
Okay. Well, let's see if I can remember their names. Rosemary Clooney.
Okay.
Related to George Clooney.
Yes, she was his aunt.
Yep. Bing Crosby.
Correct.
Danny Kaye.
Okay. I mean, those are all the ones that I need, but you can keep going.
Yep.
You can keep going.
Well, and then the thing that's crazy, so the other woman, I think her name is Viva. Is it Viva or Vivian? Or it's not Vivian. She has the tiniest waist of anyone in the world. It's her name is, I can't remember it, but it's like Viva or you're looking it up. You have to be.
Of course I am. You think I don't know that answer. I was just going with, I wanted you to say Bing Crosby and Danny Kaye. Those are the answers that I was looking for. But the fact that you knew that it was Rosemary Clooney and Vera Ellen.
Vera Ellen, that's it. I knew it was V-E, Vera Ellen.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got to get that to stick in my brain. She is the most amazing dancer. You know, people may not put White Christmas in as a World War II movie, but it is.
Well, I do.
And it's so great. Do you? I love it so much.
It's on this list, isn't it?
Yes. I love it so much. White Christmas.
Excellent. Okay, let's spin the wheel for your next question. Round and around and around the wheel goes. Ooh, okay. Let's see how good your memory is from last year. In the movie Saving Private Ryan, On what beach do Miller and his men land on D-Day?
Omaha.
Yeah, very good.
Because not a lot of people landed on Utah.
Not a lot of people landed or made it through.
Well, no, I mean, comparatively. So over 2,000 people lost their lives on Omaha. Over, you know, only approximately 200 something lost their lives on Utah. And so, you know, and like, so the 79th, the 4th Infantry Division, and who else landed on Utah? 79th, 4th, the Engineers, Special Brigade. Is that all? There's one other, 79th. They landed on Utah. But then there's a whole host that landed on Omaha. So there's just a vast difference between the sizes that landed on those two beaches. I don't know the exact number. I wish I did. Maybe I should find that out. But I will say the reason there were so few casualties at Utah was thanks to Dick Winters.
Of course, because he took out
the four guns at Breakcourt Manor.
And the 105s in Breakcourt Manor. Exactly.
Yep.
And that makes sense.
With a plan that is still taught at West Point Academy.
No,
today.
It's not. No, it's not. Well,
that's what that. I was told.
We've talked about that. They have it here, but that is complete bullshit.
Really?
Yes. My guest, when I interviewed Eric Flint, he pointed out that is not true.
Well, that's crazy because my son Hunter in the Army told me that does happen, that they do use it.
Well, let's put it this way. Eric Flint is a military historian, and he said he went through all the books in West Point and said that he didn't find any reference to Dick Winters about
oh,
that.
Oh, well, maybe it's not at West Point. That's true.
And that basically it's something that, you know, Dick Winters didn't create some new method of doing it. He just used something that was done in the past. But he said nobody teaches today that, okay, in Band of Brothers they did this, and this is what you need to learn to do. You know, that's the way that he explained it.
Okay.
So,
again, but I will say,
I don't know either way. I couldn't tell you.
I do think that method of attack is still being taught to the infantry. And that's what Hunter was talking about.
Okay, again, that's very possible, but it's not based on something that Dick Winters
made up.
Exactly.
Makes sense. Yeah. All right, I'll give you that.
Okay, thank you. Again, I defer to Eric Flint, the expert.
Yes, we will have to because I'm not that for sure.
Exactly. All right, so let us spin the wheel once again. You get two more of these. And, oh, wow. Let's see how good your memory is from yesterday. This sometimes happens also where you get something that's, you know, that we talked about before. And so in the 1977 film A Bridge Too Far, what major Allied operation is depicted?
Market Garden. That Excellent. One I know.
There you go.
Hey, and guess what? I was at the Market Garden reenactments not this past year. So I think it must have been in 2023. And it was so cool because they had current paratroopers from the Netherlands, the United States, France, Belgium, and they were all jumping over. Italy was there too. They were all jumping over the same fields where they had jumped in 1944. And my son Jonah was a rigger, or not a rigger, but he was a part of the rigging team, and was there during that time, which is why I was able to be there and be on that. Oh. Like drops them. It was just really.
Did they manage to do it this time?
Yeah, they did. They managed to do it.
they got to that last bridge. That's good.
Yeah.
Very important. Very important.
Sure was.
All right. And now let's spin the wheel for one final time and see what you get. Okay, there's a chance you know this one too. Okay, what classic film features a team of Allied prisoners of war, including William Holden, who are forced to build a railroad bridge for their Japanese captors?
I think this is one of my favorite ones. Hold on. What is wrong with my memory right now?
It's from 1957, if that helps.
That also does not help.
Also starring Alec Guinness.
Yo, Alec Guinness, yes. He's such an amazing actor.
Yeah, and it's not Star Wars.
No. I know it's not Star Wars. Bridge over the River Kwai.
Excellent. Nicely done, Christina.
Thank right. you.
Yeah, and now we will play the daily game of Name That World War II movie. So let's
okay.
Spin the wheel again and see what you get. Okay, I gotta say I'm gonna be a little surprised if you've actually seen this movie, but but you never know. You have been known to surprise. Okay, this is a movie from 1964, starring Cary Grant and mm-hmm. Leslie Caron.
Mm-hmm.
About a man that is living on an isolated island. And end up finding himself responsible for taking care of a teacher and several students.
You are going to be extremely surprised because I know this one. This was the very first World War II movie I ever watched with my husband.
And there's no blood. So that's
there is no blood. This one is like one of my all-time favorites. And it is called Father Goose.
Ooh, wow.
Right? Right?
Yes, it is. You are correct.
Yay. Yes, everybody should see that one. It's a great one to introduce girls to World War II movies. A great date movie.
Okay. An interesting way to convince a girl to go see a World War II movie.
Yep. It'll work. Okay. Or you could tell them, you could take them to see mine, which is I tell everybody it's a love story and it's a great one for girls.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, I've seen yours too. I don't know if I would call that a date movie, but still,
it's not a date movie per se, but it is a World War II film that women would enjoy.
Yes. Okay. That is definitely fair enough. All right. So, Christian, would you like to tell everyone where they can find Christian Taylor?
Absolutely. You can find me at documentaryfirst.com. You can also find me at all the social media places on Documentary First. And also, you can listen to me on my podcast, Documentary First.
All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Run Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, movierunminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movierunminute@movierun.net. So, until tomorrow, Craig!